All of our mothers, all sentient beings throughout space, need to be brought to the state of completely perfect Buddhahood. In order to do this, we must study the Dharma, and so that is the reason why we are gathered here today to study the Dharma. The Dharma that we are studying is the way of the Bodhisattva by the great Bodhisattva, the great being Shantideva. And in this text, the way of the Bodhisattva has three main sections after the introduction, of course, and sort of include, you could say three main sections. There's the introduction, there is the body of the text, and there's the concluding section. Now, the main body of the text has three portions as well. The first is recollecting the benefits of bodhicitta. Second is how to develop bodhicitta, how to take the bodhisattva vow. And the third is how to, once we have taken it, how to preserve it and preserve it without weakening. So we are currently discussing the benefits of bodhicitta. The benefits of bodhicitta, we have discussed we've finished the section on the six different analogies for bodhicitta. We have discussed about the various other benefits, the visible benefits, the benefits taught by the Buddha. And so now what we've come to, when we think about the benefits of bodhicitta, we also have to think about the other reasons why bodhicitta is not only beneficial, but why it is so precious, why it is so rare. And so we have come to the 23rd verse in the first chapter. So what I will do this afternoon is I will go through quite a bit until we get to the section in the second chapter on going for refuge, and then we'll do the refuge and whatever other activities we have to do there. So bodhicitta, as we discussed this morning and last night, when we're talking about developing bodhicitta, initially as beginners, we're primarily talking about the relative bodhicitta. And what is relative bodhicitta? Aspiration? Is it merely aspiration? There are two types. There are two types of relative bodhicitta we went over this morning, and you weren't able to be here this morning. So when you talk about what actually bodhicitta is, what is bodhicitta? Compassion is the cause of bodhicitta. So anyone else? Motivation. It is a motivation. What type of motivation is it in particular?
The wish to attain Buddhahood
for the benefit of all sentient beings. Thank you, Sheila. Yes, exactly that. So the wish to achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of sentient beings, right? So when we have this attitude, wanting to achieve Buddhahood for sentient beings, this is a very precious attitude. Now let's go through this. What are the two types of relative bodhicitta? Aspirational and engaged. So what's the difference between these two?
One is about how you wish to go, wish to...
Yeah, that's right. You're going, yeah. So just as they know the difference between the wish to go and going, the wise should understand the contrast between these two respectively. So relative bodhicitta, aspirational bodhicitta is the aspiration, I am going to achieve Buddha, I want to do this, I really want to do it. Engaged bodhicitta is actually doing it, actually engaging in the practice, taking the step down the path. So you have to have the aspiration first, and then you can do the engaged bodhicitta. Now, when you take the bodhisattva vow, there are different ways to do it. Some traditions say that you take the aspirational bodhicitta vow first, and then later, after you really meditate upon that, then you take the engaged bodhicitta vow. In the tradition of Shantideva, you take the two at the same time. But we'll talk about that a little bit more tomorrow. At any rate, this wish of bodhicitta is an incredibly rare, because frankly, most people don't even think about it. Even if you hear that there's a Buddha, the idea that we can become a Buddha is just like completely foreign to most people. Most people hear about Buddhas, and before you study Buddhism, you may well think that a Buddha is a sort of God. In fact, I was speaking with my father the other day, and he's pretty educated, but not in Buddhism. And he said, you mean a Buddha isn't a god? I said, no. A Buddha was a human like us who made the aspiration to become a Buddha, and because of that was able to do it over the course of a long period of time, but certainly not a god who descended from heaven and said, now I'm the Buddha. That's not that. The Buddhahood is a potential we all have, and that wish to awaken it within ourselves and to awaken it in others. And this is an incredibly rare wish. Who has such altruism as this? Does even a father or a mother, or do the gods or else the sages, do even Brahmas harbor this? So we have to, in this verse, just to remember, to understand the words, we have to understand a little bit about India in the 8th century, 7th century. A lot of people, in fact, Brahma appears in Buddhist literature as well. There's, you know, Buddhists accept that there are gods. We don't accept that Brahma created the world. The Hindus say Brahma created the world. Some of them do. Some of them say it's different. But at any rate, but in Buddhism we say that we accept that there are gods such as Brahma, but does Brahma want to become a Buddhahood, to become a Buddha, to bring all other sentient beings to Buddhahood? No. Brahma is just, you know, enjoying being Brahma, four faces, hanging out in the form realm, being the person who created the world, or so thinking. So Brahma doesn't have this wish of bodhicitta. The sages here refer not, sometimes we talk about sages as referring to the Buddhas. Here it doesn't mean this. This means Hindu sages, non-Buddhist sages. They want to do good for people. They want to help people, but they don't necessarily have the idea of Buddhahood, the idea that everyone can achieve Buddhahood. The gods, you know, the other gods, they don't have they don't have any conception that there's anything better than them. So how would they want to achieve Buddhahood? So even a father or a mother, generally the person who wants the best for some, like a mother who has a little baby, she wants that baby to grow up and be happy, to be secure, to be safe, to be free of any problem and have a good, happy life. She wants the best for her baby. She'll do almost anything to make sure that her baby gets the best. But what mother wants her baby to become a Buddha? So if even a mother or a father, forget about a mother, forget about a father, if mothers don't want to forget about fathers, basically, you know. So parents don't want this for their children. They can't even conceive of it. And so for us to develop the wish of bodhicitta, to say, I want to do this for all sentient beings, we have a wish for the benefit of all sentient beings that even those beings' parents, you know, just can't conceive of. It's not the parents' fault, necessarily, that they don't have bodhicitta. Most parents just never hear about it. They don't even know about Buddhas. So it's incredibly rare to hear about a Buddha. And a lot of people think, oh, I can't do that. I'll just raise my kid. Give my kid a good life. That's the best I can do. And that's a great thought, and it's a really important thing to do if you have children. But for us to have bodhicitta is even more rare than that. So if sentient beings themselves have never had such a wish as this before, even for their own sake and dreams, how could they have it for another? So the reason why our parents and our mothers and all the other spiritual teachers, because it's written in India, the previous verse used Indian examples, we can add to it. We can say, do the rabbis, do the priests, do the preachers, do the imams, do they have this wish for anyone sentient beings? They've never had this idea for even themselves, so how can they have the idea that any other sentient being should be brought to Buddhahood? Forget about it. They don't even know that they can. This is a really important difference between Christianity. I'm going to speak in particular about Christianity because I don't know nearly enough about Judaism or Islam to really say anything. But, you know, like with Christianity, you go to heaven by grace of God. And it's kind of strange, is it predestined or not? But you go by grace of God. You get to heaven if you're one of the lucky few that God bestows his grace upon. But you don't become like God. You don't achieve that state yourself. In Buddhism, we're saying that you don't go by grace of God. You go by your own efforts. You just need the Buddha to show you. And when the Buddha shows you the way, you can actually become a Buddha yourself. You can develop the qualities equal to those of a Buddha. And, you know, the Buddha's... this is a real digression, I'm sorry. Should I digress like this or not? One of the proofs of the existence of God that was given in the Christian faith is what's called the ontological argument. The ontological argument is basically saying you can't think of anything greater than God. Because you can't think of anything greater than God, then because you can conceive of this, then therefore God must exist. So God exists because, and I don't completely get this argument. It's a very difficult argument. But even God does not have the wish to bring all sentient Buddhist beings to the state of Buddhahood. Even the God does not have this. So we can conceive of something that's greater than God, which is a bodhisattva, frankly. You know, so therefore God does not exist. Does that follow? I don't know. But we could say that maybe the Christian God exists. I'm really digressing here. I better get back to the text. At any rate, this is a wish that that no one has. It's a supreme wish that that any being could have. It's so incredibly rare. We should really celebrate it. So the wish to benefit beings that others have never had for their own sake, the special jewel of mind is born, a wonder without precedent. So it's so extremely rare. The fact that we have had this opportunity to discuss it, let alone, I mean, maybe you haven't, maybe you're not convinced yet, but even the fact that you've heard it is extremely rare. And so to even more than that, to develop the wish of, to develop this attitude is just an incredible, unprecedented wonder. It's so extremely rare. The cause for every being's joy, the cure for being's suffering, how could one take a pressure of the merit of this precious mind? There are all sorts of passages in the sutras that talk about, you know, if you took all of the good acts, and if you took all of the acts of generosity as numerous as sand grains in the Ganges River, and you took all that merit, it wouldn't compare to even a fraction of the merit of bodhicitta. So there's just no way to compare the merit. Sometimes when you talk about comparing merit is a difficult thing because it's not like it's got some sort of a form. You know, when we talk in sutras, sometimes it makes it sound like the merit of bodhicitta couldn't even fit within the billion-fold world realm, which is sort of like saying within the galaxy. But it doesn't really have a form of its own. But there's no way you can measure the merit of this because we have this incredible concern for all sentient beings who are infinite. The wish of bodhicitta is infinite. So if merely intending to benefit is greater than revering the Buddha, what need to speak of striving for the sake of all beings' happiness? So the wish to intending to benefit, this is like when we talk about loving kindness. So loving kindness is the wish that all sentient beings be happy. And this is said to be one of the highest of all merits. When we talk about the Brahma Viharas, the merits that are so great that you will be reborn in the realm of Brahma, perhaps even as Brahma himself. Regular acts of merit, regular acts of generosity and so forth, can't compare to this because a regular act of generosity has a limited result, whereas being reborn as Brahma is like a huge result. That's just from developing loving kindness. But even that merit that comes from meditating on loving kindness, being reborn in Brahma's realm where lifetimes are millions of years long, and it's just a lifetime of pure joy and pleasure because it's on the level of the first jhana. It's an incredible result, but the merit that comes from bodhicitta is even greater than this, because this is the merit that leads to Buddhahood. But many sentient beings haven't yet developed this wish. So as it says in the 28th verse, they wish to cast off suffering, but rush towards suffering itself. They wish for happiness, but deluded, crush their own happiness, crush their own pleasure like a foe. So sentient beings, in general, want to be happy. I mean, there's no one who doesn't want to be happy in some level, or at least be comfortable. I mean, sometimes it's not fashionable to say, I want to be happy. and you say, I want to be happy, people often think that what you're talking about is the just, you know, enjoying yourself. In fact, if you do a Google search, I was trying to look for that. I was putting together a presentation for a class I was teaching someplace, and I wanted to look for a picture to illustrate happiness. So you do a Google search, and most of the pictures that you find are going to be of young people frolicking on beaches. So it actually worked for the presentation because I was looking for something that sort of show happiness. Is this really happiness? But, you know, so we think of happiness as being that sort of frolicking spirit, but that's not necessarily what we mean. The Sanskrit word sukha, that we translate as happiness, can also be translated as pleasure or as comfort. So basically, when we talk about wanting happiness, what we mean is we really want a state that is free of suffering. The great happiness here, the ultimate happiness, is really not having something to make you happy, but just not experiencing suffering of any of the, as I spoke about, was it last night? It was last night, about, you know, suffering being the whole gamut from just discomfort all the way up to out and out suffering. So not being free of any of that, that's what we mean by happiness. So people want that state where they don't suffer, where they can just relax and be comfortable and be happy. But they don't know what causes that, and because of that, they rush towards suffering itself. They mistake the causes of suffering for happiness. So they mistake making a profit, getting something. Often, you know, hunting is a big one in New England. You know, killing. Hunting is killing, but people go out for a good time. They go out fishing for a good time. And this is pleasure for them, and yet it's also the cause of future suffering. So they wish for suffering, but deluded, they crush their own pleasure like a foe. So they're just destroying their any chance of actually getting that which they really want. So for those deprived of happiness who suffer many miseries, this satisfies with every pleasure and severs every suffering. So what bodhicitta does is, when we can connect with these beings and bring them closer to Buddhahood, bring them to a point where help them learn what it is that you have to do in order to become happy and what you have to give up in order to avoid pain and suffering, then that will bring them to their happiness. It satisfies them with every pleasure, because all pleasures essentially come out of merit, out of doing virtuous actions. All suffering comes out of unvirtuous actions. And so it severs every suffering. And once they learn, in other words, what they learn, what it is they need to do, and what it is they should avoid doing by learning this sort of ethical action, then they're able to bring themselves happiness. And it is by through the kindness of bodhicitta that we learn what to do. It also will dispel delusion. How could there be such good as this? How could there be a friend as this? How could there, and then there's a missing word here, I'm sorry. This was not proofread by anyone else but me. How could there be such merit as this? So bodhicitta also destroys delusion. In fact, that's why it's able to bring people to happiness and free them from suffering. Because the main cause of our happiness is delusion. Our main cause of our unhappiness is delusion. So when we overcome delusion, then we will, in karmic terms, we will stop doing things that cause harm and therefore cause suffering for ourselves and others. And we will start doing the things that will bring us all happiness. So how could there be such a good as this? How could there be a friend like this? How could there be such merit as this? So these are the, you know, really bodhicitta has many different functions. In fact, that's what these three verses are called in the outline. It says it has many functions, or it has many actions that it does. The next verse talks about how bodhicitta is different than other types of merit because it's not dependent upon anyone reciprocating. We don't expect something good when we do other things. We often have the hope, oh, I'll do something nice for someone and they'll help me back. I'll give them a tip, and next time I come in, they'll give me good service, basically, taking that mentality. But bodhicitta is different. It's not hoping for any response for the other person. In fact, expecting that probably the other person may not be able, or understanding that the other person may not be able to give a response, or appreciating it when they don't respond with kindness, because then we have an opportunity to practice patience, and so forth. So, if to reciprocate a kind deed is praiseworthy for a short while, what need to speak of bodhisattvas who do good unsolicited? So, no one's asking us to achieve Buddhahood for their sake, partly because they just can't conceive of it. But we're doing it, and we're trying to achieve a state where we'll be able to help all beings. Now, you know, people don't necessarily want help. I mean, on a kind of worldly example, as my father is, you know, kind of shaky around things, but he's not very stable on his feet. He's not doing things, but don't volunteer to do something for him because he wants to do it himself. So there are a lot of beings are like that. They want to do it for themselves. They don't necessarily know though. So, you know, we do what we can to guide them. And so, without looking, just sort of, you know, grab the cane and put it near my father's hand so that he can take it as you go. You know, things like that. You can help in ways like that. That's kind of a small example, but there are different ways. You know, we're doing it not because we're expecting anything in return from other sentient beings. We don't have any expectations about them. We don't even expect them to necessarily, you know, feel willing to receive the help. But if they want it, it's there. That's the point about it. It's completely unconditional help. So another way of looking at the benefits of bodhicitta is in comparison to worldly sorts of good. People extol as something good, people extol as doing something good, those who provide a few with regular meals, donating scornfully for a short time plain food that satisfies for a half a day. What need to speak of those who always give to beings untold number for a long time the sublime happiness of the Sugatas, fulfilling every one of their intentions? So, you know, if you have an upstanding member of the community who goes and makes a donation towards goodwill or the homeless shelter, so I'll help some of those homeless people today. I'll feed them lunch. It'll be fine. It's a good thing to do. It'll make me look good in the community, but they're homeless people. They're kind of scornfully. People will say that person has done something good. On a certain level, maybe they have. But generally, you know, we'd say that someone who's, you know, donating to the food kitchen, oh, that's very good. Donating to the homeless or whatever. Of course, people say that that's very good. So if we say that this is good, even if their attitude is not good, and even if they're giving, okay, the only thing we can afford to give them is frozen French fries. You know, and that's, you know, having frozen French fries for lunch, you know, it's kind of a plain meal or something, maybe a little bit, I don't think anyone's going to do that. People will give at least something, maybe some canned vegetables along with the French fries and some, I don't know, a plain meal because they want to stretch it to feed more people. We say this is a good thing, and it is. But what need to speak of those who always give to beings of untold number for a long time the sublime happiness of the Sugatas, fulfilling every one of their intentions? So bodhisattvas who work to bring benefit to all sentient beings by generosity, by the other activities of a Buddha, of a Buddha and a bodhisattva, and eventually bring them to the state of Buddhahood. That is, you know, giving them such a greater gift. So how is there any comparison? If we say that the one is doing good, then what is the bodhisattva doing? Not only that, the bodhisattvas are the bodhisattva is such that no matter what sort of a connection you make with the bodhisattva, the that connection will always end up somehow turning out good, no matter how evil your intention is. As it says, someone who arouses a malicious thought towards such a patron, the offspring of the victors, will dwell in hell as many eons as the number of their bad thoughts, the sage has said. But the results of someone feeling faith proliferate in far greater abundance. With bodhisattvas, even grave events don't bring misdeeds, good naturally increases. So the bodhisattvas, generally when we're talking about karma, there are some things that make an action have a much greater result. One of the most important is, of course, your motivation when you're doing it. And the stronger your motivation, the stronger the result, whether it be a positive action or a negative action. Similarly, when you do a positive or a negative action, the power of the action also depends upon the person that you're doing it to and how beneficial they are, how much kindness they've shown you. So, for example, actions that you do towards your teachers, your parents, or Buddhas, or Bodhisattvas, or great beings, are said to have a much greater karmic impact than a similar action done towards an ordinary individual. Just because with your parents, they're someone who has given you the greatest kindness, this human body. With the Buddhas and the teachers, they're the ones who give us the opportunity to achieve liberation. And so this is why it says here that someone who arouses a malicious thought towards such a patient, offspring of the victors, will dwell in hell as many eons as the number of their bad thoughts. So it sounds pretty bad. But the results of someone feeling faith proliferate in far greater abundance. So if you feel faith in a bodhisattva, then it's even has even greater results. But with bodhisattvas, even grave events don't bring misdeeds, good naturally increases. So even if you do a grave misdeed toward a bodhisattva, it ends up actually, in the short term, which may not seem so short, but in the short term it may lead to a terrible rebirth. But in the long term, it leads you to Buddhahood because of the nature of the connection that bodhisattvas make with all sentient beings. The bodhisattva, if someone harms a bodhisattva, the bodhisattva is not going to get offended. That's, you know, the point is the bodhisattva sees this person is harming me because they are deluded and feels a special compassion for that person. So, I mean, there are different ways that this verse is interpreted, and there are two different ways in the commentaries, and just let me get this open so I get them right. The first way to interpret this verse is to say that actually it is extremely rare for any being to do anything harmful to a bodhisattva, because you've got someone who's obviously, I mean, like, someone who's universally recognized as being a helpful being, like, for example, the Dalai Lama. I mean, who's going to do anything, well, okay. Yeah. He does have a security detail, yeah. Okay. But, you know, but generally, you meet the Dalai Lama, and it's extremely difficult to feel anything other than, you know, faith or love. I suppose other people have different experiences, but even if someone should, because of the feel a negative thought or do a negative deed towards a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. Because of the power of that being, then they'll kind of get stopped halfway through it, and they realize, oh, I'm doing something bad, and that'll become respect. And then therefore, their virtue will naturally increase, good naturally increases. Their merit will naturally increase because of this. That's one interpretation. It's like the story of, should I digress? Like the story of Supushpa Krama. Supushpa Metodadze. What's the name? Metodadze in Tibetan. I'm going to use that name because I don't remember the exact Sanskrit name. He was meditating by the king's palace, and the queens came over. No, he was meditating near the park. The queens came over and saw, oh, what a great being. They started venerating him. The king got jealous, came over, cut his limbs off, cut his head off. Milk flowed instead of blood. The king felt terrible, built a statue, and later on became the Buddha. So, you know, it's like this sort of thing. Because of the, you know, so the connection of doing this and then realizing what a mistake he'd made, then he naturally increased his Buddha, became the Buddha. Now, another way to do this, to interpret this verse is saying that even if someone does something incredibly harmful to a bodhisattva, tries to kill a bodhisattva, they think that they're trying to harm the bodhisattva, but for the bodhisattva, because of their strong bodhicitta, they can't be perturbed by it. They're just, it doesn't faze them. Someone's trying to hurt me. Okay. I've given my body, I've given everything over for the benefit of all sentient beings. As it says later, let them revile it, let them play jokes with it, let them kill it or beat it as they wish. I've given it over to them. So what? Fine. So, because of this, their beings cannot be disturbed, and in fact, it becomes a cause for them to increase their merit and their meditation and so forth much further. So these are two different interpretations of these two verses. So I prostrate to the bodies of those in whom this jewel, the sublime attitude, is born. Even harming them will lead to happiness. I go for refuge to the wellsprings of joy. So it's the bodhisattvas who bring us the opportunity for happiness in this world. And I think when we're talking about bodhisattvas, of course, you know, I'm giving this from a fairly traditional, I'm teaching based on a traditional commentary, and I'm being relatively traditional in my commentary on this. But it's also important to realize that when we say bodhisattvas here, we don't have to limit it to people who are called bodhisattvas. There may be people who act like bodhisattvas in who do things that like that help many people. For example, we could say that we could view, Jesus as a bodhisattva, and say Jesus has done incredible good things for millions and millions of people. Over the Christian teachings have benefited an incredible number of people. They still do benefit people. They encourage people to practice love, compassion, and to be generous and to try to help people. And this is incredibly good. This is a bodhisattva's activity. We could say the same thing about the prophet Muhammad, any of the prophets of the past, and all of the other different religious traditions. We shouldn't necessarily just think of bodhicitta and bodhisattva as being a proprietary trademark of Buddhism that comes with an R and a circle at the end of the name. It's not like, you know, a course you're going to find at some yoga retreat center that says Bodhicitta Yoga TM, you know. So it's important that at the same time we need to not just think that bodhicitta is our own Buddhist, only a Buddhist thing. It can appear in many different ways. And for people who are not able to hear it in a Buddhist way, then it can be presented in other fashions. So that's the end of the first chapter, and what I would like to do now is let's all just read this first chapter together. One moment. Because it's long enough, we'll only read it once, and then I'll move on to the second chapter.